From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Gray. I'm in for Cynthia Candy. Today we'll hear about legislation that would allow seizing guns of unstable people.
The judge has to grant it, similar to a personal protection order.
Michigan State University is building a central database to document the African slave trade.
The other tragic part of slavery is because people were treated as property, there are lots of records.
We'll check out the Detroit music scene with a look at Jack White.
He really ushered in a new era for rock music alongside other garage rockers, but also, you know, new wave post-punk revivalists.
Then a quilt honoring black men, women, and children who were lynched.
I chose to not show their mutilated bodies. I chose to just have the instruments of their death.
Black bodies swinging in the southern breeze.
Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. Last week's mass shooting at a school in Florida is affecting proposed legislation in Michigan. Kathy Gray with the Detroit Free Press reported some of the bill's expanding access to guns will probably be shelved for the time being, but others might get a hearing they otherwise probably wouldn't have gotten. Representative Robert Wittenberg, a Democrat, introduced a bill last summer on restricting gun access. He joins us now. So what would your bill do?
So this bill, in essence, someone is making a threatening statement that they're going to harm themselves or they're going to harm someone else. And this gives, with due process, a family member, law enforcement, the tool to be able to petition the court to get what's called an extreme risk protection order so that you can temporarily seize their weapons and make sure that they're not able to purchase any more weapons until they're in a better place. We want to make sure they're in a good place before they're able to have their weapons. And so, unfortunately, we've seen the worst examples of when this would have helped is in California some years ago at UC Santa Barbara, and just recently in Florida. This student there, his mom was calling the police, but there was nothing they could do because until a crime has actually been committed, then there's nothing law enforcement can do. There's no recourse to actually take someone's weapons away while they're making these threatening statements. And so what we want to do is make sure, again, with due process, to be able to take the weapons away from them, make sure they're in a good position, and then get the help they need. And again, it's temporary, and if it's frivolous and someone tries to do it improperly, then there are penalties. We don't take this lightly, but we know this is a way to prevent these tragedies from happening.
Yeah, I was going to get to that. I mean, when you start talking about seizing someone's guns, that's going to trigger an immediate backlash from pro-gun folks. How do you make sure the government isn't going to be randomly pounding on doors and demanding firearms once they get some writ from the judge?
Again, there's due process, so you have to present evidence. The judge has to grant it, similar to a personal protection order. We want to make sure that this person is qualified and they are in a good place to be able to own their weapon. I would go back to what happened in Florida and say, if we had this in place in Florida, the law enforcement would be able to take their weapon away, take that person's weapon away, and get him the help that he needed. And we wouldn't be having this conversation right now because we wouldn't have lost 17 lives down in Florida.
The chair of the committee that would hold hearings on the legislation you proposed indicates he'll look at the bill to see if it merits a hearing. How likely do you think we'll see a hearing?
I had a conversation with Rep. Runstead, the chair of the committee, yesterday, and he said he's willing to read it and take a look. I'm cautiously optimistic here on this bill specifically and then with all bills with gun safety. You know, after Sandy Hook years ago, when nothing happened, I was frustrated, and you kind of throw your hands up, and you're like, what is it going to take? The shift I'm seeing now is that you're seeing middle school students and high school students, future leaders of our country, are actually getting involved. I've received countless emails from middle school and high school students that are really pushing what I'm presenting specifically and also making sure that we're pushing more for gun safety across this country and here in Michigan. And so, you know, Rep. Runstead is going to have to keep that in mind, at least have a hearing. I would love to discuss the merits of this bill and how this could potentially save lives. Because one thing I would love to cover, while these mass shootings are terrible, you know, roughly 114,000 people are shot every year, and 60% of gun violence and gun deaths are suicides. This is a tool that can prevent suicide as well. And so we have to look at this holistically. We know that this has been implemented in other states, in Connecticut, in Indiana, California, Oregon, Washington, and there is data that shows that this policy saves lives.
There are other bills, including restricting gun access to people with personal protection orders, requiring universal background checks, expanding the places that could be gun-free zones. In the wake of what's happened in Florida, the shootings in Florida, will any of those see the light of day?
I would hope that they would. Most of these bills have been referred to the Judiciary Committee, and that's Rep. Runstead's committee, and so I want to have these conversations with him. We're not trying to take someone's Second Amendment right away, but we have to have this discussion of what we can do, the bills that can make our state safer. We are trying to make sure that guns don't get into the wrong hands, to prevent it from getting to people who should not have them, and then again, being able to take them away from someone who is a serious and immediate threat to themselves, to their school, their family, or their neighbors. I hope we get the opportunity to not only present this set of bills, 4706 and 4707, which we've called the Extreme Risk Protection Order, but also some of the other bills that you've mentioned that we've introduced and that have not got a hearing just yet. And that's something I've been pushing for. I chair our Gun Violence Prevention Caucus here. There are quite a few things that we're working on that we know will make our state safer.
That's Representative Robert Wittenberg, a Democrat from Oak Park. Thanks for taking the time.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Lester.
Mass shootings like the one last week in Florida can leave people like Chris DeMannon feeling nervous. He's a retired high school counselor from Canton.
In light of the fact that it appears more and more instances of various kinds are happening through the world, what if I'm in a spot where I might be able to help? I'd like to be able to feel like I got some kind of an idea, at least, of what to do.
With that in mind, hospitals around the country are putting on free workshops to teach people like DeMannon how to prevent someone from bleeding to death. The goal is to make bleeding control more common knowledge, like the Heimlich maneuver or CPR. Stateside's Lindsay Scullin attended one of the classes last month. And to warning sensitive listeners, you'll hear details of life-threatening wounds in this story.
Chris DeMannon was one of about 20 people who came to this Stop the Bleed class at Beaumont Hospital in Trenton. It's led by Rob Roulet, the hospital's EMS liaison.
Our pre-hospital people are trained to do this, and the hospital people are trained to do this, and the ERs, but the general population is not. Where most of the injuries happen is out away from here.
Bleeding to death is one way people die at the scene of a mass shooting. But Roulet told the crowd mass shootings actually aren't the main reason for this Stop the Bleed class.
Sure, we talk about the big massive events that happened, like in Las Vegas or the one out on the East Coast several years ago with all the kids. That's not the norm. The norm is the car accident at Fort and West. That's the norm. Work-related injuries, if you're still working, I heard a gentleman retired from 30-some years at Ford. A lot of injuries happen in the plant. Not a lot of mass shootings. Home injuries is the most common.
My name is Ernesto Madrigal. I am from Ecorse, Michigan, and I was cutting a piece of wood, and that's what the accident happened. I cut three fingers, so I did the natural thing, put a cloth and press it until my help came on, but I did stop the bleeding. You see the finger? That's what stopping the bleeding is about, and I want to, in case of an emergency, I want to help somebody to help them stop the bleeding.
Madrigal's instinct to press on his wound was right. Rulli said, after calling 911, compression is the first step.
We want to find the bleed and then put something on it right away and start controlling the bleeding. Is there a trauma kit or a first aid kit available that we can use? And if the answer to that question is no, use anything you can. Anything you can, it doesn't matter. Tear shirts off, whatever. Start compressing, stuffing something into that wound to try to stop the bleeding. So don't just put it over the top, make it look pretty. Jam it down in there. It's going to hurt. Push it down in there. Get as much of it as down in the hole as you can, and then cover it up on the outside, and then start packing it. Okay? Just keep packing it. However much it takes.
Nurse Barbie Loretto is the injury prevention coordinator and registrar in the trauma department at Beaumont Trenton.
Pick a wound, sir.
She's teaching part of the class how to pack a wound.
Any wound?
No, this one. Here.
This one. Okay, so what you're going to start doing is you're going to start putting your finger in there. You put your finger in the gauze, yep, and you just start packing that wound. Okay. And you'll be surprised how much goes in there. Keep in mind, this person's screaming, right? This isn't fun for them. This is, A, they're worried about losing their life. B, this hurts more than I want to know. What I found, though, is if you do voice matching, I don't know if you know what that is. So if somebody's screaming, you talk lower. A lot of times they'll stop screaming to hear what you're saying, and you can get them to calm down a little bit, okay? The other thing I always encourage is always ask them questions. Do you have any kids? How old are they? Are they in sports? Okay, so it's a distracting technique.
Well, I've had to put the whole thing in there?
You keep going until you can't get any more in.
Oh, I see.
Mm-hmm.
But if you've packed a wound, held pressure, and the bleeding still hasn't stopped?
Use a tourniquet. It's a device used to wrap circumferentially around a limb to put pressure on the blood supply to that limb to stop the blood from coming down to stop the bleeding out of the wound.
That's Dr. Alan Lamb, the hospital's trauma medical director. He's helping Gwen Navas with the trauma department at Sinai Grace in Detroit teach people how to use a tourniquet on an arm or leg. Navas said never put a tourniquet on a joint and make sure it's about 2 inches above the wound.
Just turn it. And the person, when it gets tight enough, will go, ah, let's go a little tighter. Okay, and then bring it up.
Rulay said a quality tourniquet costs about $30.
You don't have to have some super elaborate trauma kit. And if you can't afford one of these things, you can use a t-shirt. Wrap a t-shirt around and put a stick through it and then twist it, and it works just like the tourniquet. And I've seen patients that could have had something done that didn't because of maybe lack of knowledge, or maybe they were just afraid. And that's what we want to do is decrease the fear so that people will do something. We just had one here just recently, just about a half a mile from the hospital, where it was a car accident, very, very bad leg wound. Somebody put a tourniquet on while the EMS was en route. When the EMS got there, they just left that tourniquet on, picked the patient up, brought him to the trauma bay here.
And that tourniquet helped save the patient's life. For Stateside, I'm Lindsay Scullin.
The next bleeding control workshop at Beaumont Trenton happens tonight at 5. To find the next class at a hospital near you, you can go to bleedingcontrol.org.
I see the whole world different now. You see my whole world different now. You in the sky better learn to fly before your spaceship hits the ground. Tell me who should get the crown. You see, this is what you get for now. I see the whole world different now. You see my whole world different now.
Coming up, we'll check out some new music from Detroit area artists. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Let's talk about water. That's the invitation from the Michigan Humanities Council to organizations and groups around the state. They're accepting applications for groups to host Third Coast Conversations, dialogues about water in Michigan. Shelley Kasprisky is the executive director of the Michigan Humanities Council. Here she is speaking with Stateside Cynthia Canty.
Good to have you with us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
What's the significance of that title, Third Coast Conversations?
Well, the state of Michigan is often referred to as the nation's third coast because it boasts miles of shoreline. Of course, we have 4 of the 5 Great Lakes that run around Michigan, so we really like to think of ourselves and boast as the third coast in the United States.
So tell us about this new grant program. What's the purpose of it, and what are these conversations?
Well, we were very excited to be awarded this funding from the National Endowment for the Humanities with the purpose of really allowing community conversations to take place around the critical subject of water here in Michigan. And that can mean a number of different things depending on the community. For example, in some of our communities, the tourism industry is almost solely driven by its access to water. In other communities, it's safe and clean drinking water that is a primary issue for a community to discuss. And in other areas, yet again, it's access to water and who has the rights to water. So the Michigan Humanities Council, in an effort to promote those stories that we all share, sought grant funding for Third Coast Conversations, and we were very fortunate to receive it.
So who is this aimed at? When you're saying we are accepting applications, what's the opportunity you're offering with this funding and to whom?
This is an opportunity for local communities to be able to discuss the cultural, social, historical, and environmental factors that really play into water in their community. So we may receive applications, and we'll provide funding to 20 sites, but we'll receive applications from nonprofit organizations, museums, libraries, perhaps schools, who will actually host a humanities-themed project and discussion around things like indigenous communities and water, infrastructure and industries and challenges of urban water systems, recovery and resilience of waterways, rights and access to water, how we enjoy water as a tourism industry in our state. Those are all good examples. And we have a panel of scholars that are volunteers with our organizations who are experts in the field, and they'll be helping evaluate applications as they come in. The applications are up to $5,000 awards, and we think it's just a very exciting opportunity for our state and even more importantly for our local communities to really delve into such an important topic.
Shelley, when we think of understanding Michigan's water resources and issues regarding water in our state, we think of marine biologists or perhaps economists. Why are the humanities important in this conversation?
Well, humanities are so critical to this conversation because we identify our state and our communities with the water issue, with Third Coast, with being a state where water is so important. And the humanities offer that historical perspective and the ability to really connect to one another through critical thinking and discussion. And that's really what humanities are all about, looking at the human story behind very important topics that are very relevant to our state and to our communities.
So these are going to be 20 conversations to be held over 2 years?
That's correct.
How do groups apply and what is the deadline for applying?
Applications are due March 16th. We have online submission of grant proposals, and you can do so at michiganhumanities.org.
Shelley Kasprisky, Executive Director of the Michigan Humanities Council. Shelley, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Well, each month we listen to new music from Detroit area artists. This time the theme is anticipation. After some 4 years, three artists are set to release new albums. Here's Cynthia Canty again, speaking with Paul Young, founder and publisher of Detroit Music Magazine, and executive editor Khalid Bhatti.
So we're going to start with somebody who began his music life with classical piano at the University of Michigan School of Music when he was 4 years old. And those days, he was Andrew Wilkes Creer. Today, he is?
Andrew W.K. Yeah, it's hard to believe that this man that we know now as embodying the idea of party rock.
The self-proclaimed king of partying.
Exactly. That he started with such conservatory-like roots. But, I mean, in his teenage years, he did move into playing with some Detroit-based DIY punk and metal bands. And through that, he carved a niche for himself, which is this, like, weird hybrid of metal, pop, and even, like, dance music that kind of parodies and pays tribute to the cheesiest, sleaziest aspects of those styles.
And he does it really, really well.
I have to say,
he's really good. So, Paul, tell us about kind of what he's been doing through his career.
Yeah, I mean, Andrew WK has become more of a, like, he's kind of this, like, this brand, this idea, this movement, more than just a musician. And certainly he's a songwriter, you know, a producer, but he's also an author, a columnist. He's appeared in TV shows. He's had radio programs. He's become a motivational speaker and done some pretty serious touring around some big colleges and And then also he's owned a nightclub. So he's kind of all over the place, but he's written for the Village Voice. He's appeared on shows like The Daily Show and Late Night with Conan O'Brien. That might have been the first time I ever saw him on late night TV, just like acting insane. And he's also performed on Saturday Night Live. And he, I think he writes for Vice right now. He did a column for Front Magazine, just all over the place. But if you follow him on Twitter, like any sort of social media, you can find that he's always dishing out these pieces of advice. And he's always under the guise of partying. So partying can be, you know, the literal sense of going out and celebrating. It can also be putting your nose to the grindstone and studying for the big test. So he dishes out these little nuggets of truth through the lens of keep partying. And it's all about kind of positive energy. And it's just really interesting. He's a totally interesting figure.
And now his sixth full-length album is coming out on March 2nd, entitled You're Not Alone. Let's take a listen to a track, Music is Worth Living For. Newest album got that you really, really like?
Well, I think it's funny because I want to quote Andrew W.K. himself because I think he says it best. It's his first album since 2010, his first full-length release. But in a statement, he said, I'm going for the sound of pure, unadulterated power. Every emotion, every thought, every experience, every sensation, every fear, every joy, every clarity, every confusion, every up, every down, all extruded and concentrated into one thick syrup of super life force feeling and then physically amplified by the celebratory spirit of glorious partying. And I mean, that sort of distills...
Quite a mission statement.
Exactly. That's all his Zen cones that you read on Twitter. It's all there, but I'm excited to hear what it sounds like on record.
And now we go over to rapper, songwriter, and producer Black Milk.
Yeah, Black Milk... He's a mainstay of Detroit rap. He sort of is continuing the legacy of J Dilla. He was part of Slum Village. This crisp, loop-heavy production. And he's had quite a storied career, so it's exciting to see what he's going to come up with next.
Paul, tell us about Black Milk's place in Detroit's hip-hop scene.
Yeah, so Khaled alluded to kind of carrying on the legacy of J Dilla, and that is just like soulful sampling and just like the mastery of the really traditional hip hop instrumentations. And I think he's evolved, and now you see it in his work, he's using a lot of like live instrumentation, working with Nat Turner and his live band that he tours with. But as far as Detroit is concerned, he's worked with Fat Cat, Guilty Simpson, Slum Village, of course, J Dilla, Royce da 5'9", Elzai. He even put out a two-sided 7-inch album with Jack White, which is really interesting. But his versatility is just... his instrumentation, everything about him. Hip-hop purists absolutely love him. But he's also able to reach like new generations with this big, awesome live sound. So we're really excited for the new album.
And his first album since 2014 is dropping on February 23rd, Fever. Politically charged?
I mean, you would imagine so, given the climate that we're in and with Black Lives Matter and all this heightened attention toward identity politics. But I think... Black Milk is going to deliver it in a way that doesn't read as polemical, but rather as pure music.
All right, let's hear some of a track called Laugh Now, Cry Later.
Evil remains, world ain't really changed. Moments of feeling anger, next moment you entertain. Laugh through the pain, my nigga. It be those same celebs you seeing the starstruck. Same time, see them appropriating the culture. Cry later. I see the whole world different now. You see my whole world different now. You in the sky, better learn to fly before your spaceship hits the ground. Woo!
tell me who should get the crown. You see, this is what you get for now. I see the whole world different now. You see my whole world different now.
Khaled, how have you heard his sound evolving?
He's a consummate, like, evolutionary, you know, in terms of how his sound changes with each album. In 2006, he put out his first debut full-length, and it happened to be the same year that not only J Dilla died, but Proof died. And I think that sonic landscape is, you know, he's there filling the void a bit. And I think he doesn't find his footing until a couple years later with Tronic, where he adds synthesizers. And it's music that's equally appropriate for the club or for listening to on your headphones. From there, he started adding the live instrumentation that Paul mentioned. The album is called Album of the Year. It's the same year he suffered another set of setbacks. One of his close friends died, and his manager, Hex Murda, suffered a stroke and was left in a coma. From there, he continued to move on. He did a collaborative EP with Danny Brown, which is called Black and Brown. And then the last two albums have seen him investigate the darker side of soul. No Poison, No Paradise, and If There's a Hell Below. And I think if There's a Hell Below, really nightmarish, and it's really digs deep into, you know, how dark you can get with these classic soul samples. But I'm excited to hear again what he's going to pull out with Fever.
And now we turn to someone who needs very little introduction, Detroit-born rocker Jack White. And Paul, we know Jack White's living in Nashville, has for a while, but remind us again about his Detroit roots.
Yeah, I mean, he grew up in Southwest Detroit, not far from Clark Park, and he went to the Holy Redeemer Catholic School right around the corner there. He went to Cass Tech High School, but, you know, also he obviously exploded onto, you know, the international scene. He's got 12 Grammy Awards. He recently sent a record player into space. He's been doing a lot of, like, kind of whimsical, like, kind of almost Willy Wonka type stuff with Third Man Records. They also opened up shop in 2015 in the Cass Corridor. So he is just, like, he's exploded and just kind of blown up into this much bigger than a Detroit or a local rocker. Obviously the White Stripes, but the Raccoon Tours, the Dead Weather. And so he's just kind of all over the place.
And Khaled, what do you see as his influence on music?
It's followed a trajectory where as he's chased his bliss, as he's followed his whims, his influence has sort of waned. But that's sort of natural in the sense that rock music doesn't have the cultural dominance that it does. But back at the turn of the millennium, he really ushered in a new era for rock music alongside other garage rockers, but also, you know, new wave post-punk revivalists like The Strokes or Interpol. And he was looped in with that. I mean, the White Stripes were looped in with that movement. And their sound at the time was very minimal, very precise and sort of bare bones. And as he's progressed, not only with the White Stripes toward the end of that line, as he's chased his bliss with his solo career, he's introduced blues and country and Americana. And I think if there's any influence we've had, it's that sort of pulling from those areas. And I think like bands like the Black Keys, who have been around for a while, benefited from that. And as recent revivals of folk sounds, he could be partly to play for that. But I think you'll see with the next song that he's out there on his own. And in fact, he was quoted lately by saying that, you know, rock music lacks a certain wildness. Hopefully he'll bring it back. We'll see. It's sort of polarizing right now what the reaction is to his latest singles.
Well, and his newest album, Boarding House Reach, drops on March 23rd. Here is a preview.
She commands my respect. She commands my respect. And I can't recollect a better time in my life. She has all my respect. She has all my respect. And I cannot protect my heart from her command.
That's Respect Commander from Jack White's soon-to-be-released album Boarding House Reach. New album means a tour. Jack White has his U.S. and international tour kicking off in Detroit April 19th at Little Caesars Arena, and then he's also going to be at 20 Monroe in Grand Rapids April 21st. Both shows are sold out. What are people in for?
Yeah, so the last time he came around was after his Lazaretto album release. he in Detroit, for his second night in Detroit, he was at the Masonic Temple, and he performed his longest set, I think, ever up until then. So we're certainly looking forward to him returning. After his last tour, he made a public statement saying that he was going to take a little break from touring. So people are certainly thirsty for him again. Since then, the pressing plant in the Cass Corridor opened up, so he hasn't been out of the spotlight. Certainly busy with that endeavor, but I'm really excited to hear him play, obviously, his new stuff, but also being at home, hopefully we'll hear some of his classics as well.
Well, you can learn a lot more about today's featured artist and many more with Detroit Roots by going to DetroitMusicMag.com. Our guides for our excursions into Detroit music, as always, Paul Young, founder and publisher of Detroit Music Magazine, and its executive editor, Khaled Body. Guys, thank you so much. Always fun.
Thanks, Cynthia.
Always a pleasure.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Still to come, a quilter, April Shipp of Rochester Hills, talks about her tribute to the black men, women, and children who were lynched in this country. That's in 10 minutes, here on Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. Researchers at Michigan State University are gathering every scrap of information they can to develop a huge database on the African slave trade through the centuries. The project is called Enslaved. Joining me to talk about the effort are Dean Rayberger, who is the director of Matrix and an associate professor of history, and Walter Hawthorne, a professor of African history, both at Michigan State. I got to ask you, where do you even begin to track down this information? I mean, some of it's centuries old now.
Well, the nice part about this is that in recent years, there's been a lot of projects across the country that have been developing. And a lot of our partner sites have been doing this for more than 20 years, collecting this kind of information. What we're really doing is trying to bring all these different projects that really are siloed and separate from each other to be able to talk to each other.
When it's complete, who will likely use this information?
This is Walter. We anticipate the project will be used by a range of individuals. First and most obvious, scholars. Scholars who are interested in expanding our knowledge of slavery and the Atlantic slave trade. Second, the general public. And I would put that really into two categories. I think it'll have great utility for K-12 classrooms. There is a great need out there for teachers to have access to information about slavery and the Atlantic slave trade. In fact, just a few weeks ago, my daughter's in middle school. A few weeks ago, I went into the middle school and gave it a full day's lessons on slavery and the Atlantic slave trade, since it's really something that's not taught adequately in many K-12 classrooms. And finally, genealogists.
Right. Came to my mind first, these folks who want to trace their roots. Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of the projects that we have, including a couple that are here right now at Michigan State University, we have a project called Slave Biographies. A lot of these projects are already used by genealogists. As you said, this is a place where you can go and there is information in there about individual enslaved people, who their owners were, where they were, who they were married to, these sorts of things. So one of the beauties, I think, of this project is that if you have information about a particular relative and you know something vague about the time and the place, you could plug that information into our hub, into our system, and it would pull up information about that person or somebody with a similar name on any number of databases scattered all over the globe. So really a terrific tool for genealogists to use.
Yeah, and another part of the project that's really important is there's all kinds of professors and faculty members around the world actually working on slave data, and they're collecting it. The sad part often is they'll do their own study, they'll write up their own articles, and then they'll put that data away in a drawer. And so one of the things we're also trying to do is make a space where people can deposit their data. So we're not only looking for people to come to us to search for data, but also come and deposit data that they might find.
This sounds like an ongoing project. I mean, is there any point you say, okay, we've got a complete set of data, there's nothing else to be found, or does it just keep on adding?
Well, a matter of fact, this first phase that Mellon is supporting for us is what we call proof of concept. The first thing we want to do is just prove that this could be done, because it is a rather difficult text bringing together all this data, which is rather difficult data to work with. And then we do actually hope to have four or five more phases, but like a lot of our projects, it's always ongoing, always collecting more.
What are those four or five phases look like? What else are you going to be doing?
In our first phase, we have 8 partner projects. In the second phase, what we want to do is expand that to a number of more projects, say 25, 30, and then after that, just continue to grow with each phase.
Well, we'll be the place that links these projects. So we do have a couple of existing database projects here at Michigan State University. One of them is focused on information about slaves in colonial Louisiana and, interestingly, Brazil. Another one looks at records from courts that were established around the Atlantic and in the Indian Ocean when the slave trade became illegal in the 19th century. These courts were established to determine if enslaved people on particular vessels had been legally enslaved or illegally enslaved based upon international law at the time. And that collection of data from across the Atlantic and the Indian Ocean is invaluable, because in that then you get the mentioning of individual people along with descriptions of them, data about their ethnicities, data about their age, their genders, and the like. So what we're trying to do is take all of these projects that have information about individual slaves or about individual slave ship voyages. And those slaves could be found in Africa, they could be found in Cuba, Brazil, anywhere in the Americas, anywhere in the Indian Ocean. And again, these sites are scattered all over the place, these websites. We will continue here at Michigan State University, particularly in phase two, to expand data that we collect here. But as you said, to link to that information that's scattered and on servers really around the world, so that users of our hub can do a query. They might want to know something about the quantity of slaves at a particular period of time, the number of women, the number of men, the number of enslaved people from a particular ethnic group, or trace an individual. But they will be able to harness the power, harness information in many different sites right here at Michigan State University through our hub.
One of the things you pointed out is the African slave trade wasn't just, I mean, we always think of the U.S., but it was for all of the Americas. And there are many, many thousands, hundreds of thousands of people who populate those countries as descendants of those slaves. And as you mentioned, not just the Americas. They transported and stole these people and transported them other places. So I assume that this is going to be a worldwide effort.
This is indeed a worldwide effort, an effort that depends really on scholars based here in the United States and Europe and Africa and Latin America, really around the world. So we're relying on and calling on the expertise of partners in many different places. And as you can imagine, as you just said, records about the trade in enslaved Africans are numerous and exist in many different places. So there's an internal trade in Africa itself. There's a trade in the Indian Ocean. There's a trade in the Atlantic Ocean. And indeed, that trade in the Atlantic Ocean, as you mentioned, connects many different places. The number of slaves that went to Brazil was probably 10 times larger than the number that came here to North America. The number of slaves that went to a very small place, what is today Haiti, was probably twice as large as the number that came here to North America. So we're really talking about an effort that would focus on databasing, putting into database form information about individual enslaved people in a number of different places, making that information searchable, making that information quantifiable, and then allowing users to search across multiple servers, multiple platforms.
But you are right. This is a project that we hope never ends. I mean, there's so much information out there. One of the tragic parts of slavery is that, you know, people think that these lives are really lost to us, but the other tragic part of slavery is because people were treated as property, there are lots of records. You have probate records, you have plantation records, you have runaway slave ads, which are actually richly descriptive of the people who were running away, obviously, because they wanted to recapture them. You have baptismal records, marriage records. So there is a lot of information out there. It just takes a lot of time and a lot of effort and a rather high cost in some ways to collect that information.
Walder Hawthorne and Dean Rayberger, thanks very much for talking with us about the Enslaved Project.
Thank you.
Thank you.
For 6 years now, the Detroit Unity Temple has held a quilt exhibit in February. Many of the quilts, not all, but most, are tributes to African-American history. This year, a quilt that's getting a lot of attention is named Strange Fruit. The woman who made the quilt is April Shipp, and she joins me now. Hi there.
Hello, and how are you?
Just fine. Let's start with what I'll call the alarming part of your exhibit, two hangman's nooses. Why are they part of the exhibit of a quilt?
The quilt is entitled Strange Fruit, A Century of Lynching and Murder, and it is comprised of the names of some, but not all, of the men, women, and children who were lynched in this country in a 100-year period. I chose, Lester, to not show their mutilated bodies. I could have done that, but I wanted to leave them some dignity, so I chose to just have the instruments of their death present in this quilt to grab you, to shock you, to say, this is what happened to them.
Describe the colors of your quilt.
The quilt is comprised of different textures and shades of black. As you know, all black is not black. I have some silks, some satins, some polyesters, some wools, cottons, corduroy denim that I've used in this particular quilt, and that was to represent the person's status in life. You could be a sharecropper or a congressperson or someone returning from the war and be murdered in this fashion. So that was why I chose different kinds of fabric. The names are embroidered on the quilt with gold thread, symbolizing that they are all precious in the eyes of God. At the top of the quilt, it is dedicated to, well, of course, it's called Strange Fruit, but it's dedicated to Ida B. Wells, who was a journalist who fought tirelessly for anti-lynching laws in this country because they weren't illegal. It wasn't illegal to take someone from the jail and lynch them. People didn't go to jail for that. There was no crime committed for that.
The name of the quilt, Strange Fruit, of course, comes from the Billie Holiday song. You documented 5,000 lynchings of black men, women, and children. How did you go about your research?
There's a book that I referenced. It's called 100 Years of Lynching. And I also went online on the internet and I researched looking for different names and looking for counties for the names of the lynching victims. It took me 3 years total to complete the quilt from start to finish. And, you know, the quilt, Lester, if I can tell you how I started the quilt, the quilt actually started, believe it or not, with an episode of Oprah Winfrey's show. She had on her show, author, her name was Kathleen Thompson. She wrote a book called Faces of Our Past. And in the book, there was a beautiful book about African-American history and women in history and photographs of us in history. And I happened to be flipping through the book. I was in a bookstore, and I was flipping through the book, and there was one photograph in the book that shocked me. It was a photograph of a mother and her son who were lynched in Oklahoma. It was May 25th, 1911, and they were lynched over the North Canadian River, right? Now, at that time, I did not know they lynched women. I had never seen a lynching photograph of a woman, but just men, for the most part. So I searched for who this person was. I didn't know, because the caption said, unidentified woman and child. That bothered me, that this person was murdered, and no one knew who she was. So that's how Strange Fruit began, looking for who this person was in this photograph. I later learned that photographs were taken of lynch victims. They're called postcards. It was not uncommon or illegal to go to have a lynching postcard right on your back, right on the back of the comments, you know, had a great time, wish you were here, put a stamp on it and put it in the mail. And it would get delivered. Not a problem, which is shocking to me in this country. But it did happen. So once I found out who she was, I was determined to find out who the others were. Her name was Laura Nelson. She was around 33 years old when she was murdered. Her son's name was L.D. Nelson. He was about 14. And they were accused of stealing a cow or livestock. The sheriff came to their house, and I believe that her son, who was 14, shot the sheriff, you know, and then they both claimed that they both said that they shot the sheriff instead to not have them both be arrested. Didn't work. They were both arrested. They were taken to jail. The mob came to get them from jail. 40 men at night. She was raped, and they were lynched over this bridge. And when I saw that, that troubled me so. I just couldn't believe they would murder a woman like this, you know, and without a trial. The mob was your judge, your jury, and executioner.
The names are listed by state, and under Michigan, there are two names. And then you embroidered the words, 27 are unidentified. And from that, I assume there are more names out there across the nation. Do we have any idea how many more?
We do not know. Because in Laura's case, no one came to claim her body. When she was hanging from this bridge, her family did not come and claim her body, right? So a lot of times, people who were murdered in this fashion, their bodies were not claimed. Or you find a body in the woods. Or you find a body burned at the stake. Or you find a body hacked to pieces. No one knew who they were. So there are many states where you have people who are unidentified. One thing that I can say is I Louisiana, to my research, I've come that there were 993 unidentified people who were just found dead, who were just found murdered, lynched, raped, burned, whatever. And we don't know where they were. There are lots of folks who will never know all the people that were murdered this way.
So somebody comes to the temple and they're looking at the quilts and then they see yours. How do they react to it?
So, still, they're quiet. Because when you see it, it's 10 feet tall and it's 10 feet wide. And it's pretty large. And so when you realize what it is, you have to steel yourself. You have to, because you're looking at our ancestors who were murdered in this horrible fashion. And so I've been present when people have actually found their grandfather's name on the quilt. The quilt was at the Charles Wright Museum downtown a few years ago, and I was standing behind a woman. She didn't know that I was there, and she actually found her grandfather's name on my quilt. It became real for me then.
Yeah, that had to make your heart beat.
It did. And so when I show Strange Fruit, older folks in the community will come out and tell me their stories of who they saw murdered or lynched. It'll bring back a memory of when she was a child and she saw this body that was hanging, or I was talking to a woman who said she was playing in her front yard in Alabama, and this truck pulled up with the Confederate flag on the back of it and threw a body out of the truck in a croaker sack in front of their house and kept moving. So people will tell you their stories because of Strange Fruit. You know, we as African Americans, we should not be ashamed of this. I think that a lot of times we don't want to talk about it because we're just afraid of it or brings back memories of this, but this is through no fault of our own. These are our people who were murdered, and they should be known because they were all born and they all loved and they all, you know, hopefully loved and had a family and they had a life before they were murdered.
So where would you like to see this quilt go next?
The goal for Strange Fruit is to get it to the Smithsonian in D.C. I'm trying to get this because right now I store it, right? It's almost 20 years old. It's time for me to give them over to the public, you know, and I really want to have it taken there. So I'm working in earnest to get my quilt to the Smithsonian in D.C.
Well, the best of luck in that. April Shipp, the quilt Strange Fruit, which honors those African Americans who have been lynched in this country. It's part of an exhibit of many quilts on display at the Detroit Unity Temple through the end of this month. Thanks very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Southern trees bear strange fruit. Blood on the leaves and blood at the root. Black bodies swinging in the southern breeze. Strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees.
Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings and engineered by Peg Watson. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Joy Horan, Mercedes Mejia, and Lindsay Scullin. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham and for Cynthia Canty. Thanks for listening. Talk to you tomorrow.